4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we explore what it means to be living in the new geologic age. I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today we're featuring an interview with ecologist Paul Ehrlich. Stay with us.
My name is Jenny Rempel, and I'm here with Paul Ehrlich, and he first popped up on my radar in about eighth grade, I'd say, as the sort of budding feminist my mom was encouraging me to be. I chose to write my eighth grade term paper on Rachel Carson. But then this Paul Ehrlich figure just kept popping up, and there he was again in high school in my history textbooks and my environmental studies textbooks. And so when I arrived at Stanford, I knew this is someone I'd have to meet. This is a real treat. So thanks, Paul.
Well, it's great to be here. You really make me feel old.
No, that's not the intention. I wanted to sort of start by jumping in on something that you're probably most or best known for, the population bomb. Going back to that 1968 real classic that warned of mass starvation due to overpopulation, advocated for better limits on population growth. But obviously a lot has changed. You received criticism and praise over the years for that. So I wanted to just start out and ask the question, where were you wrong and where were you right, and what's changed in those 40-some years?
Well, obviously no scientist would write the same book 40-some years later than
exactly.
Originally. Most of the things I'm accused of being wrong on were little stories that I said would not happen. They were scenarios about the future, and deliberately said, these will not come true. They're just to help you think about it. I would say the biggest mistake in the book overall was it was too optimistic. But the biggest mistake in terms of prediction was that mostly the agricultural economists I was talking to, underrated how fast the Green Revolution would be adopted. And therefore, the levels of actual famine that occurred soon after the book didn't occur. They became more spread out. In other words, they were not localized famines. We've lost something on the order of 400 to 500 million people to starvation since the book was written. One of the funny things is that a standard criticism is, Ehrlich said the battle to feed all of humanity is over. And yet here we are today with more people starving than there were people starving in when the book was written in 1968. But basically the problem is the book was too optimistic. We, for example, knew about climate change and wrote about the possibilities of cooling or warming. We knew if you put crap in the atmosphere, you were going to change the climate. But the work by Ralph Cicerone and others that showed that we'd only really recognized about half of the greenhouse forcing at that time, that the other greenhouse gases beyond CO2 hadn't been identified, meant that our view that the problems with climate would probably come at the end of this century transferred them back to the beginning of this century, which we're facing right now. As a matter of fact, today there was a release of the news that the spring in 2012 was the warmest ever in the United States. Also, we didn't really realize how fast biodiversity was disappearing and the ecosystem services along with them. Norman Myers and actually Ann and I did the work on that some years after the population bomb was written. We didn't know about the destruction of the ozone layer. That was all brand new. And I think the worst thing is that we're not able to predict that starting with Ronald Reagan, almost all the advances that have been made in environmental protection in the United States and the world have been reversed, and that we would, by 2012, be moving as rapidly as possible away from a sustainable society and away from the chances of avoiding a total collapse. Is that cheery enough for you?
I That's interesting. You say that you were too optimistic.
Oh, much too optimistic.
I pause a little bit with that critique that since Ronald Reagan, we've only been moving backwards as environmental movement. Do you, because I'd like to
oh,
think
not in, as an environmental okay. movement, as a society. For example, every year there's more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere than there were the year before. Every year there are fewer populations and species of the organisms that run our life support systems. Every year we have to drill deeper for oil, go further for fresh water, face much more serious prospects of pandemics. So it's not the environmental movement. Well, the environmental movement in some ways just has failed. I mean, we have been fundamentally, and I'm included in that, a total failure.
Do you think some of that failure comes back to this precise rhetoric where we're sort of bombarding people with these negative images of failure or of escalating trends where population is rising, biodiversity loss is on the rise, CO2 emissions on the rise, exactly what you've just been saying. Do you think part of it comes down, part of this failure of environmentalism comes down to sort of the rhetoric the movement uses?
Well, what the movement should be using, and actually Anne, my wife, has spent more time doing this than anything else, is making sure when she can, working with NGOs, to make sure that their rhetoric is accurate. The issue of, is it really right to just keep scaring people and not producing solutions that actually what people want to hear are solutions? We have absolute proof that's bull. Because Anne and I have written several books on solutions. They never sell. Nobody's interested. If you write about what's actually happening, if you tell people the truth of what's going on, then they buy the books. They don't necessarily do anything. I mean, we have proven with climate change that simply telling people the science does not change human behavior significantly. And that's what our group is working on most now in the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, trying to bring the social sciences, the humanities, and civil society and people in general into an effort to understand why we are behaving so stupidly. I mean, look, we just had a long series of debates between the seven dwarfs for the Republican nomination for the presidency. Not a single issue of any real significance was raised in any of those debates. And right now, both parties agree that what we need to do is get back to growing faster, even though the entire scientific community, anybody who's looked at it closely, knows that's exactly wrong, that growth is the disease, not the cure.
Speak a little bit more about, it's the MAHB, or you're calling it the mob, correct?
Well, we like to be mobsters. It developed around the turn of the century when there was a Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which said, once again, what the scientific community has been saying with great regularity. We stay on the course we are now. Our life support systems are going to deteriorate to the point where society will collapse. And a bunch of us, Anne and I in particular, but Don Kennedy, who was then president of Stanford, decided that what we needed were not any more assessments of the science of what's happening to the environment. We know that very well. There's no debate in the scientific community about that, just like there's no debate on whether global climate change is due in large part to human activities. But we were not seeing the appropriate behaviors to change the course of society. And so we decided we needed a millennium assessment of human behavior rather than another millennium assessment of how rapidly the whole thing is collapsing. As we started going with it, we discovered to our horror that many people in the social sciences hated the term behavior because it goes back to Skinner's behaviorism. And so we decided, rather than fight with them, to change the title to the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere. And it's picking up steam, but it's pathetically slow. But there are more and more social scientists interested in this. We've had social scientists come to the Ecological Society of America meetings and talk to ecologists about how you change people's minds and how you change behavior. There's a big Congress of Sociology this summer that's going to have a day on this issue and the mob. So we're making progress, but the progress is too damn slow compared to the rate at which the system's running downhill.
So would you say one of the primary goals of the mob then is really, even if you're trying to avoid this sort of touchy term behavior, but one of the primary goals is, in some sense, to translate these these findings and this knowledge base into some sort of mass behavioral shift.
Yeah, it is my conviction, and it's shared with all the scientists I work with, that incremental change, a little bit here, a little bit there, is not going to solve the fundamental problem. We have to look very hard at the huge issues, like how do we get some kind of global governance? Because we obviously, many of the problems like climate disruption, like the deterioration of the epidemiological environment, that is our increasing vulnerability to huge plagues, that wars over resources, we're having a big one now over fossil fuels in Central Asia, and the Chinese and the American military are gearing up to fight each other there. And so on, all these things require global governance, which we clearly don't have. Just right down the line, there's a whole series of huge issues which come back to what are people for? That is the real goal for humanity to have as many individuals as you can using as much junk per person as you can until the whole mess collapses? Or should we, for example, re-examine our having rebuilt the United States for the last century around the automobile, should we maybe start a program of rebuilding it around people instead? Should we maybe allocate the vast majority of automobiles to the one thing they're really superb for? And that's, of course, places for teenagers to mate. The nice thing there is you don't need gasoline or engines. You know, they can be, all you need is tinted windows, maybe.
And in a back alley somewhere. Yeah. Interesting. Okay, a new form of population control. We'll just take all the cars off the streets. So part of this concern with behavior or with humans' inability to sort of translate this knowledge into action comes down to some almost, I don't want to call them fundamental truths, but some unfortunate trends or tendencies of sort of humans' evolutionary trajectory. And I think you've thought a bit about this in terms of our ability to think on longer term scales, or the fact that we're primarily visual thinkers, or I don't know if you have any thoughts on why is humanity failing us in this way? Where are we evolutionarily limited?
The roots of our success and our failure are in our brains, obviously.
Yeah.
And we have various ideas about why human beings so suddenly developed very large brains. But in evolutionary time, it only took us a couple million years to get really big brains. And actually, the huge changes, that is the so-called cultural revolution and the agricultural revolution, are, in evolutionary terms, very recent. None of these problems could have developed without the overpopulation that led to agriculture. And that's only 5,000 to 10,000 years ago. So that means it's less than a 20th of the time that modern human beings walked on the planet. And it's much smaller portion. After all, we've been around, our clear ancestors have been around for something like 5-6 million years, depending on where you count the split from the chimpanzees. But for most of that period, there was no point in planning for the long-distance future. If Australopithecus was changing the climate, it wasn't, and it couldn't do anything about it if it understood it. So there was no point in having long-term planning. After all, what our ancestors were really good at was ducking a rock thrown at their head, running away from a leopard, and so on. But long-term change, until very recently, was not an issue for Homo sapiens, either genetically or culturally. The people that our ancestors always associated with were very similar to them genetically, spoke the same language, had the same norms, and so on. And that was perfectly reasonable for the basically millions of years we existed. We and our predecessors existed as hunters-gatherers, as procurers of food. The shift to being producers of food was a dramatic shift. And again, just 5,000 to 10,000 years ago, depending on the place. And suddenly, one family could grow enough food to support itself and feed more. And that led to specialization for various reasons, so that you could have soldiers and carpenters and priests and what have you. And then you get hierarchies and you get dominance and you get war and all the other neat things that characterize us. But genetically, of course, and largely culturally, we're still back in the old days. Where our cultural evolution has gone most rapidly is in our technological abilities. For example, suppose you could resurrect Darwin and put him in a modern biology lab. he would be totally puzzled by the amino acid analyzers and so on. It would take him quite a while to get caught up on what has been learned in the couple hundred years, 150 years, since he was really active. If you brought Plato back today, a couple thousand years later, he could sit in on any philosophy class, and if he understood the language, he could get into the discussion. I mean, many philosophers say that all of philosophy today is just footnotes to Plato. Now, it isn't that our evolution on the cultural side, on the how we treat each other side, has not progressed in those couple thousand years, but it's been a trivial speed compared to how fast our technological abilities. So you basically have kind of a Stone Age animal equipped with space age tools and not well educated. Our education system does a miserable job of trying to bridge the gap that has been created between those two kinds of cultural evolution.
And what have you been learning in the mob about how we can sort of accelerate cultural evolution? Do you think that's a reality? Can we keep up with the pace of technological change? Or?
Well, we haven't. We have learned, obviously, small things so far. But we're only beginning to get the information together. And there are really tricky ethical problems, too. In other words, who gets to decide what our trajectory ought to be and so on. That's why we're trying to make it a ground-up operation where as many people as possible can get into the discussion. What we would like to do, though, is spread the word on the constraints. That is, recently people have been saying what we have to do is get the population growing again in Europe so that we won't have so many old people. Well, of course, having the age composition of the population shift towards older people is simply a mathematical function of stopping the population from growing. The only way to keep the population perpetually young is to have it grow forever, which, unless you need remedial work in arithmetic, you know it just isn't going to happen. So you don't sit around letting people argue about whether or not they should start the population in Europe growing again, when all the analyses show that in order to support today's population, with many people not being supported well, many living in misery, many hungry, to do that in perpetuity, you'd have to have at least another half an Earth. To support everybody now alive American style, you'd probably need 4 or 5 additional Earths, and they're not available. So we have to do our planning within the constraints that represents.
I mentioned earlier that back in high school and certainly in college courses, you're such a figure within the environmental movement that you're almost set up as this field of thought that humanity operates within these strict environmental limits. And that field of thought is, you know, for better or for worse, set up as diametrically opposed to sort of the Julian Simons of the world or the Prometheans, who really have this faith in technological solutions and human ingenuity. And
are mathematically challenged.
Okay.
I mean, for example, Julian Simon said that we have enough information in our brains and our libraries to keep the human population growing for another 7 billion years. Now, it was an interesting calculation. Well, not only is it a long time, at any recorded rate of growth of the human population, let's suppose it was even growing at, instead of the present growth rate around 1% or so a year, it was growing at 1/1,000,000% a year. At that rate, you would have, long before 7 billion years go by, more people than elementary particles in the universe. In other words, there is no countering genuine idiots. And the fact that people say, oh, we can easily support 16 billion people, or we can easily do this or easily do that, I've been listening to that now for those 40-some years. When we wrote the population bomb, we were told repeatedly that modern technology would allow us to feed, house, clothe, and take care of, educate as many as 5 billion people, no problem. And when we said, why don't we try supporting the 3.5 billion we have now that way before we talk about where we go? No, don't worry about it. Well, of course, now we have 7 billion people with as many people as were alive when I was born living in misery, and people are still talking about how easy it will be to support 15 billion or 20 billion, whatever number they come up with. Well, these are people who know nothing about it. In other words, you've got to separate the people who are just gibbering idiots from those who have seriously looked at the issue and spent real time working on it. And the fact that, say, Rush Limbaugh thinks I'm wrong doesn't affect me at all. scientists live by their reputation with other scientists who've looked carefully into the situation. Every book Ann and I have ever written, or with other colleagues, has been reviewed by the best people in the world. The papers we publish, just published a paper in Nature, went through a long peer review process where people check it out. So just because Julian Simon comes along and says it's wrong, so what? I mean, you know, the people believe in all sorts of nonsense.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I fully feel that. Maybe I set this or I framed this a little bit poorly. I guess I'm wondering more about whether you have any faith in technological solutions or how you see the interplay between cultural evolution and sort of technological advancements as parts of a whole towards our movement towards addressing these environmental issues. Are they factors that are opposites?
Let's put it this way. I don't have faith in anything,
okay.
Period. But this clearly we need to use technologies very cleverly if we're going to get out of our present fix. We're not at the point where we can go back to very simple technologies, to hunting and gathering and using stone axes and using bows to make fire and that sort of thing. That's not going to happen. So we have to use technology. One of the things we have to do is use it extremely carefully, and we don't. For example, we have now released something on the order of 100,000 toxic chemicals into the environment, many of which are endocrine disrupting compounds. And we're seeing all kinds of nasty symptoms. And we, for example, don't check on the chemicals we release. There's a good example where certainly some of the synthetic chemicals we've made have proven in various ways to be very useful. Many of them are just dangerous, and we have not done the cost-benefit analyses carefully to let us make decisions even one at a time. In other words, if you have a chemical that has a great promise for curing cancer of the pancreas, one would ordinarily say, okay, let's use that. Try not to release any of it into the environment, but if a little bit gets out, that's a cost we can bear because of the large benefit. If it's a similarly dangerous chemical that makes eyelash glue a little stronger, then you might say, no, we just don't manufacture it. But particularly since we haven't looked at the interactions, we know in many cases there are synergisms between toxins. That is, you take one unit of one, and it gives you a 10% chance of dying. You take one unit of the other, and it gives you a 10% chance of dying. You take one unit of the two mixed, and it gives you a 50% chance of dying. And we've got the possibility out there of millions of synergisms that we know nothing about, and that it would be very difficult to figure out if, for example, everybody started getting bladder cancer at the age of 7, what you could do about it. There are, at least for the climate disruption, there are at least nutcase solutions you might try. But for the toxics situation, we don't have any of those sort of behind us. Cheery, what?
Yeah. Some of your colleagues actually just published a book titled Love Your Monsters, Post-Environmentalism and the Anthropocene. Are you familiar with this at all?
No, I'm not. Okay. I know I'm familiar with the Anthropocene,
yes.
Of course.
Yeah. It's a collection of essays by Ted Nordhaus and Michael
Schellenberger. Yeah.
Yeah. And they argue sort of in the book's introduction that they argue, quote, to save what remains of the Earth's ecological heritage, we must once and for all embrace human power, technology, and the larger process of modernization, end quote. Will you ever embrace technology and this process of modernization?
They're notorious for their views. Shall I say, many of my colleagues are not thrilled by them. They have very bad taste. They can't seem to separate the you-know-what from the shinola, as we say in the trade. But, of course, nobody should embrace technology, and nobody should discard technology. Technology is one of the things that human beings and some other animals have developed. It can be used very well. It can be used very badly. Anybody who thinks that technology, that the technological rabbits that we can pull out of a hat will somehow solve the vast majority of human problems we've been discussing, I think is dead wrong. Our history is that when you pull a technological rabbit out of a hat, you don't notice its very nasty droppings that sooner all over your shoes. You know, remember, Chlorofluorocarbons were the wonder, better things for for better living through chemistry. They replaced the nasty working fluids in refrigerators, things like ammonia, so that if your refrigerator broke at night, you'd end up dead because the ammonia would come out and poison you. Chlorofluorocarbons didn't. All they did was threaten to kill every human being on the face of the earth. And, you know, if we hadn't discovered that, so you just don't embrace technology. You use technology. They're a good example of people who really haven't studied it and don't get it, but write a lot about it.
I wanted to return for a second to the population bomb, because as a sort of budding young scientist, I can sort of imagine you rigorously plotting the numbers, seeing the results, sitting there looking at these upwards trends and just having sort of a my God moment. What do I do now? When you saw this fate that humanity or this trajectory humanity seemed to be headed down, how did that affect your thinking or your sort of movement from ecology or from sort of the strict science into a broader political or public policy realm?
If you look at the population bomb, you'll find a lot in it about pesticides because the scientific community was getting very concerned about it. And then, of course, along came Rachel Carson. She had a wonderful, some luck, that was the time was ripe for her book because a lot of us were concerned about it. And also there had been issues of fallout and thalidomide, which had sort of alerted people to environmental kinds of problems. And then on top of it, she had a brilliant mind and was a wonderful writer. I'd give my right arm to be able to write the way Rachel Carson did. And so she really started the modern environmental movement with the Silent Spring. But in a sense, she laid the ground for the population bomb in the sense that the one thing that wasn't being discussed in the context of her work was the population element in the problem. But basically, I was as concerned about the pesticide issues then as essentially she was. And a couple times I've re-reviewed her work, and she was viciously attacked. You used to talk about being a feminist. Heavy attack on her for being a woman scientist. In those days, for instance, when I joined Stanford, our department didn't have on campus did not have a single female faculty member. Now much of our strength is women. That's the change I've seen in my 53 years on the faculty here. But wow. These trends continue. She was viciously attacked by scientists from the chemical industry, in part for being a woman. Her equivalent today is a guy at Berkeley named Tyrone Hayes, who has managed to show that one of the commonly used herbicides is really bad stuff. Been attacked by industry, not well supported by the university administration at various points, as I recall, but he's black. And part of it is clearly racially motivated quite openly in the attacks in him on the blog. So one of the things that's interesting, and my two interests come together there, interest in equity, be it racial, gender, economic, is really interest in the environment, too. We're not going to solve these problems unless we get those problems solved. We are doing better in those areas. That's a place where cultural evolution, it may seem bad to you, but when I was a kid, my girlfriends, what choices did they have in the 30s if they wanted a career? They could be a nurse, they could be a grade school teacher, or they could be a secretary, and that was about it. So although women don't have equal rights in any country in the world, equal opportunities, it's a lot better than it was in the 30s. And the same thing in the 30s, the only black you ever saw in a sport was Joe Louis in boxing, and the newspapers would actually talk about the need for a white hope. I mean, I get hope from the fact that even within my own lifetime, the things on that other side, the non-technological side, have changed dramatically, even though not far and fast enough.
And then I guess another equity concern, which gets at humans' sort of inability to think in the long term, has to do with inter versus intra-generational equity, which is a big one when you're thinking about these long-term problems like climate change, like biodiversity loss, and similarly like overpopulation. I was wondering how you view these trade-offs, or are they even, because sometimes they are explicitly trade-offs between helping people who are suffering today and helping future generations.
No, I mean, it has to be considered. I have to say, I've worked probably more with economists now than with ecologists often. And they have looked at these issues of intergenerational equity. I have my own theory for what presents a real problem there, but it's utterly unsupported by any real evidence. And that is, as you get further out there, you have more and more difficulty relating to people further in the future. Just like you have more trouble relating to people in the past. You certainly probably knew your grandparents reasonably well. Did you not?
No. Yeah, no, I did. Yeah.
How about your great-grandparents?
Yeah, similarly, not so. Yeah,
I mean, they fade back, and your great-great-grandparents you probably can't even name, right? And then you go the other direction. So, in part, it's part of our built-in areas of concern. We concern easily with a certain group, and then, I mean, one of the problems we've had always is the in-group, out-group, how easy it is to define people as being outside of humanity because we are so accustomed to being evolutionarily to being in uniform groups. So that's one of the things we got to break down. I think if you break down, if you think about some of Peter Singer's ideas about how you spread sympathy and empathy and so on, if we break them down, I think you'll get the breakdown not just in geographic distance, which is a big thing, but also in temporal distance. We'll learn better to try and consider future generations, but that's always going to be incredibly tough because of what assumptions you then have to make about what's their utilities, what do they want, and also what capabilities will be left to them. Will they be so rich and so technologically advanced that we can just blow everything today and they'll solve it all? I think that's nonsense, but that's one view you could take. Or will we have left them so little that they'll be descending into a sort of pre-human state? Nobody knows.
Yeah. So,
but we ought to think about it.
Exactly. And I think a lot of the problem comes down to this issue of time horizons. And it's not just with regards to equity or sort of conceptualizing what future human societies will look like, but it's also humans in our short-term thinking or our tendency towards short-term thinking really struggle with the messages or the realities of biodiversity loss, of rising CO2 levels, because you want to convey this sense that there is some urgency, some need to act, but it's also hard to deal with this impending crisis or this.
Particularly when you can't see.
Exactly.
It. If the lion jumps out of the bush at you, you don't have to do a lot of thinking about whether you got an impending crisis, what to do, and so on. We evolved to deal with that essentially automatically. You can't see the rise of CO2. If CO2 was bright red and the atmosphere was getting perceptibly redder every day, then you might be able to deal with it more readily. Same thing with the accumulation of nuclear weapons. U.S. and the Russians have lots of nuclear weapons pointed at each other, more than enough to destroy the world. Why? People don't recognize it. They don't recognize the threat. They can't think of what to do about it. We have a great deal of difficulty dealing with crises like changing weather or growing population. After all, the population isn't popping up around you all the time. It isn't until you get out on the freeway that you begin to feel that we got a problem. Where you see a picture of, I saw a picture the other day of a traffic jam in China. They've done very well at building cars. The jam was 100 kilometers long. That is 60-mile-long traffic jam. Looked like about 25 lanes, and it took 8 days to clear. And a whole industry built up. The guy giving the seminar showing the picture said, bringing tea and food to the people. But there had to be an industry carrying stuff the other direction, too, by my calculation. So when you see something like that, then all of a sudden, I mean, one of the things that impressed me and which we've gotten a lot of flack on was describing the I just actually got a manuscript from another guy, had the same experience, going to Delhi at the time of the Bihar famine. And seeing basically everybody living in the streets, cooking in the streets, relieving themselves in the streets, and so on, it changed. There's a difference to me in how you know things intellectually and how you know them emotionally. I know a lot of kids in the world are hungry, but when I work in Costa Rica and I find that the family that we're trying to work in their backyard and giving the kids a little money to guard our butterfly nets or traps or whatever, and you realize the kids are malnourished, that gets you in a different way than looking at the statistics that X million kids die of starvation every year. And it was the same thing. The thing that really got me, though, was having published that in the Population Bomb, everybody said I was a racist. I shouldn't say everybody. People accused me of being a racist because it was Indians. But, of course, In the corny, old, not accurate description of human races, the Indians and we are exactly the same race. Never occurred to me that that was a different race. But, of course, it is to some people as a social construct.
But I'm a little curious more about this inability to think on these scales or to comprehend numbers or see things or understand things that are not immediately visual, because when we make these argument that all these myriad environmental concerns are so pressing, and we sort of make these claims of I don't want to say impending doom, but
it's impending doom.
Okay, yeah, okay, yeah, there
yeah,
we
don't
go.
Worry about that. Yeah, don't
worry. But is there something wrong with that message? Because we want to convey this sense of urgency, but this sort of apocalyptic sense of doom can not only be ineffective at actually motivating behavior change, but it can also sometimes be fundamentally wrong in terms of our short-term experience
humans. Our short-term experience is rarely going to match the long-term situation, because these things fluctuate. They go up and down. You can have a general upward trend. You know, you can have a reversal for a year if the economy goes down the drain of the amount of CO2 going into the atmosphere. But if the basic plan isn't changed, it will catch up and do more right after it. But a huge amount of it is and this is what the mob is trying to do. How do you retrain people to be able to relate to these things? After all, I've often said that if you can't read a chart showing what's happening, it's a chart taken in an observatory on a mountain in Hawaii, which shows how much CO2 there is in the atmosphere. And anybody who's familiar with how the atmosphere works can look at that chart and really get scared. But if you, don't know how the atmosphere works, or worse yet, and this is very common in our society, people have no clue how to read a chart. You learn this when you're teaching. And so if you can't bring people to that, they're never going to get scared, because they're not going to see it otherwise. It's just too slow for them to react to. I mean, if you've taught a biology lab, for instance, you'll find people using a microscope carefully drawing what they see, and you realize their eye's not at the right distance from the ocular, and what they're doing is drawing their own eye. It's amazing how little people know of science, how badly it's taught, how many people think, for instance, that science proves things, which, of course, it doesn't do. How many people think there's nothing wrong with saying, I believe in evolution, when there's no scientists, certainly, all accept evolution as the best explanation we have now of where we came from and so on. But nobody should believe it. And we're always skeptical about such things. If I could show tomorrow that Darwin was dead wrong, I'd be writing a manuscript and sending it to science, because I could get all kinds of credit for doing something like that. The easy way for the average person to tell the difference between science and, say, Republicans is the scientists are willing to change their mind when data comes in, whereas the Republicans are going to tell you that the fact that this was the the hottest spring of all time in the United States has got nothing to do with human-caused climate change. It may not. But the point is, you never just always stick with your story because it's your story. I have been shown to be wrong scientifically. Fortunately, the first time when I was a graduate student, I was shown that something I dearly believed was dead wrong. And that was a very, very useful thing in my training.
So you do speak about these times when you're proven wrong. But going back to the population bomb, we've learned so much since then, but what are some of the big messages that ring true and that you really would emphasize today, 40 years later, to this current generation?
Well, the basic message that the size of the population can always outstrip the resources available to it was basically Malthus's message. Malthus' social views were not mine and so on, but Malthus was, after all, a couple hundred years ago and one of the great economists of all time, and he was correct there. And the basic message of the population bomb, that the size of the human population was a very important factor in bringing us towards a very unhappy end, is not only clearly true, it's been repeated by the scientific community so many times one gets sick of it. I mean, in 1993, there was both the statement of 58 academies of science that said it. There was the World Scientist Warning to Humanity, which was signed by more than half of the Nobel laureates in science that said it. The British Royal Society this year just got out a report saying it. It's not even a matter of debate in the scientific community. Not at all. I mean, sometimes scientists write idiotic things about it. But nonetheless, it's just that part of the message is just arithmetic. Unless you can believe that you can an economist, Kenneth Olding, said in 1966, anyone who thinks you can have perpetual growth on a finite planet is either an imbecile or an economist. And that, it just shows you, nobody doubts that. The idea that somehow that would be controversial is still absolutely amazing. And you still have people on left and right who seem to think that you can grow forever. And there's, by the way, a wonderful new movie out called Growth Busters, Hooked on Growth, which everybody ought to look at. It's the first one that has basically said, the idea that Obama seems to have that it'd be good to get the economy growing at 3.5% a year simply knows he really either does grasp exponential growth or compound interest and feels he has to lie about it or in order to get reelected, or he just doesn't understand just the way many, if not most, economists don't understand. Some economists understand very well.
And yet you say the people you're working with most these days are economists.
Yeah. Huh. Ken Arrow here at Stanford, who is probably the smartest economist in the world by acclamation, Nobel laureate in economics. Partha Dasgupta, who he and I have been battling with Science magazine to get a good article published. He's the top economist probably in Europe. He's head of the British, was head of the British Economic Association, the European Economic Association. Absolutely brilliant. There are Larry Goulder, right here on Stanford campus, the chair of our economics department, one of the few economists that we have around here who's doing anything interesting or useful.
So there is obviously, or there are problems, huge problems with these sort of assumptions that disregard the science and urge us to grow. But there also seems to be something of a problem with the way we sort of posit ourselves as opposed to so much of the economic movement or so much of like Republicans as an entire sector. And
well, by the way, I must point out to you, I was a registered Republican for many years. When they nominated George W. Bush, I, knowing his record in Texas, I could no longer stand it. The interesting thing is that our first representative here was Pete McCloskey, a Republican who we voted for many years. And within months of the time I left the Republican Party, Pete, a Republican congressman, sent me an email saying, I am quitting the Republican Party. You should not vote for any Republican. In other words, not a matter of Republican versus Democrat. It's what has happened to the Republican Party. We need a responsible conservative party in this country, but it no longer fits the Republican model. Burke would be rotating in his grave if he could read some of the crap that's being put out right now.
Well, I might shift a little bit.
Those are not views, official views of Stanford University, by the way. They're just my official views.
Good clarification. We might shift a little bit away from that. I wanted to return to this sort of heady feeling that you seemed to assume when you were talking about Rachel Carson and talking about sort of the late 60s where you had Vietnam and you had a lot of issues sort of coming together in American society that led to this youth movement. And I think many generations since the 1960s have looked back to that decade and that era as something that they can aspire to. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts on whether we really accomplished what we set out to or whether we whether there's hope for this current generation with the Occupy movement or if with this sort of aggrandizement or emphasis on the 1960s as an era of change is maybe something that we should move away from.
No, I think the era of 1960, look, society never changes just in a gradual monotonic direction towards something. It goes and fits and starts, and as I was indicating earlier, it goes backward sometimes. But the 60s, was a very interesting time, in part because the environmental issues became close enough to the surface that people had to start paying attention to them. When Rachel Carson wrote her, remember, we already had fallout and thalidomide and so on. So it was in the air, and she was in a beautiful position and brilliantly brought it forward. The war issues, I think, were generated in no small part because of the existence of the draft. But it did bring to it's the first time in my life, at least, that there was questioning of whether a war was right, and questioning the government's propaganda, and questioning what we were being told in the media. I mean, in the Second World War, there was nothing like that. We were clearly right. Everything we did was good. Everything they did was bad. It turned out to be close to that, in my view. But nonetheless, there wasn't the kind of analysis that has been around, in a sense, ever since. So I think that was very good. I think the change in the role of women, the sexual revolution, all were very positive things. Again, I think society is better off today in those areas than it was when I was born, no question. Trouble is that the whole situation is getting worse so fast that the improvements there aren't enough to stop it. So society can change very rapidly when the time is ripe. And on the issues we've been talking about, what I'm hoping that is that people will get together and work hard to ripen the time.
Thank you for coming in. This was wonderful.
My pleasure. I've had a great time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?